Good afternoon, everyone, and very warm welcome to what I'm sure will be a very lively debate. It's the first debate here at the LSE for this new academic year, and I'm very pleased to see a great panel. A great presentation will be delivered and a great discussion afterwards. My name is Sarah Heyman. I'm a lecturer here at LSE in EU politics. I'm also one of the founders of VoteWatch, which is a transparency organization based in Brussels. And I must say, from a personal point of view, this event is really a great milestone for me, in a way, in that we started VoteWatch in 2009, and I'm very pleased to see VoteWatch for the first time taking part in an event here at LSE. We've come a very long way from when we started in 2009 to now, looking ahead to the next European elections. I'd like to introduce also Michiel van Holten, who sits here in the front row, who's the managing director from VoteWatch, and Doro Francesco on the panel, who's a policy director at VoteWatch. And I'm very pleased to see the two of you taking part in this event here in London. Usually we have all the debates in Brussels, so this is a great way of seeing my two worlds in Brussels and London finally meet here in London too.
This is occupied territory, I guess.
Yeah. Before we start the presentation, I just wanted to mention one little note, which is that we are of course looking at the European Parliament this time, but VoteWatch does work on transparency in the EU in general and also reports on legislation passed in the Council, so you can look up how governments vote and adopt legislation in the Council as well, which is what we will pursue in greater detail also in the years to come. But really, without much further ado, apart from a very important piece of information, is that after the debate, I'd like to also welcome you to a reception hosted by the European Parliament Office here in London, here in the old building in the senior common room. So if you feel like staying on and continue the debate afterwards, you're very welcome to join us for a drink at that reception. Otherwise, thank you all for coming, and I hope you'll enjoy this debate and that you'll come to many of our events during this coming year.
Thank you. Thanks, Sarah. At the risk of repeating a couple of things you said, let me introduce everybody up here with me and also myself. I'm moderating the debate. I hope everyone will be relatively unrowdy. I think so. We're all kind of well-behaved gentlemen here. I'm Shireen Wheeler. I used to work for the BBC and used to enjoy and use VoteWatch as a resource, which I hope you do as well and will in the future. I'm now working for the European Commission as spokeswoman for regional policy, but it's in my capacity as visiting fellow here at the LSE that I'm chairing, so strictly neutral. Happy to introduce Mats Persson, who is the director of Open Europe, who I think represents a genuinely, in the true sense of the word, sceptical stance. We need to rehabilitate that word, and you're helping to do that. We also have I'm working hard on it, Polner, who is head of public affairs at the European Parliament Office here in London. Very happy to have you at slightly short notice, but great that you're here. Simon Hicks, some of you, many of you, most of you should know. He's a professor of many things, comparative and European politics here at the LSE, and also co-founder of VoteWatch, along with Sarah and along with Doro Francescu, who is the policy director of VoteWatch. And Doro is going to kick off for us. Before you do, though, let me remind you that if you are tweeting, the hashtag is hashtag LSE2014. That's pretty easy to remember. Also, there will be a podcast of this debate afterwards, and you can find that on the LSE website, and you can find that by going on Google. And after all of this, we will have, as Sarah said, a bit of a reception. But the idea is, first of all, that we have a presentation from Doru, and then we'll give our reactions and go to you fairly quickly, I hope, for some comments and questions so we can have a debate about this very important issue. So, Doru, you've been looking at, broadly, how the European Parliament has been behaving politically, as opposed to personally, over the last term, and the coalitions, the positioning over key legislative areas, voting patterns, that kind of thing. So you're going to tell us a bit about that, and also your latest project, My Vote Project 2014, which is aimed particularly at younger voters. So over to you.
Thank you very much, Shireen, and thank you, Sarah, for the introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here with you tonight. What I'm going to do, just as Shireen said, is to give you a presentation of the main trends in the European Parliament, the seventh legislature of the European Parliament. We are going to look at how the politics is done in the European Parliament. We are going to see not only the fact that the European Parliament puts its footprint on European legislation, but also who exactly in the European Parliament, what kind of political families, what kind of political alliances shape this footprint that the European Parliament has on European legislation. And then in the second part of the presentation, we're going to look at one of our latest project, My Vote 2014, that is targeting young voters, so the non-experts in EU politics. So, first of all, what influences the outcome of a piece of legislation in the European Parliament? There are basically three factors that help a political group, one of the seven political groups, to shape the legislation in the Parliament. First of all, factor number one, the number of seats that each of the European political groups has. Obviously, this is not something which has to be explained. But secondly, and now we go into the more complex type of information, it's the intra-group dynamics, the cohesion of each of the seven political groups in the House, as well as the extent to which the members of the European Parliament from that political groups do take part in votes in the Parliament. And by the way, the presentation that I'm going to show is based on roll call votes cast in the European Parliament so far, so since July 2009, when the current Parliament has taken office. So it's based only on these roll call votes where MEPs vote by pressing the buttons, and this is recorded in the minutes of the European Parliament. The third factor that influences the outcome of a piece of legislation is the intergroup dynamics, so the pattern of coalition formation between the seven political groups in the House. As you, I'm sure you are aware, there is no clear majority versus opposition system in the European Parliament. For this reason, the dynamics in the Parliament is much more extensive than in a national Parliament. So I will start with what's the most interesting aspect of the work in the Parliament, and who wins the vote. So who exactly puts its footprint on the European legislation, which of the political families. So what you see in each of these two images is the extent to which each of the seven political groups in the House has been able to be on the winning side in votes cast in the European Parliament's plenary so far, since July 2009 to this year. And each of the pillars represent one of the political groups in the House, so I will start naming them from the left to the right. We're talking about the GUE, that is the radical left, the Greens, the Socialists and Democrats in red, the Liberals and Democrats in yellow, the EPP in blue, the ECR in black, and the EFD. So what the graph on the left-hand side shows us is that the Liberals and Democrats group have been able to win most of the votes, so they are ahead of the other European political groups. They had won almost 90% of votes between July 2009 and the 1st of January 2012, so for the first half of the term. Whereas on the right-hand side, we see a different picture. We see that after that period, so overall, now it is the European People's Party. You see the blue pillar being bigger than the yellow pillar. That shows that the European People's Party has won more votes overall currently in the European Parliament. So there, at some point around January 2012, there was a change in the dynamics in the European Parliament, which has allowed that the European People's Party wins more votes and shapes more the European legislation than the other groups. And the next slide shows what exactly happened. First of all, there was a change in the type of documents and the policy areas being voted the most in the European Parliament, whereas, for example, until the end of 2011, about 11% of votes were on civil liberties issues and only 4% on agriculture. Since 1st of January 2012, there are only 2% of the items regarded civil liberties, but the items that come from the agriculture policy area jumped to 12%. So it's more that the Parliament started to vote on different issues than that there was a change in the intra and intergroup dynamics in the Parliament. So as I said, the factor number one in influencing the outcome of a piece of legislation in the Parliament is the number of seats. This number remains constant, obviously, since the start of the term, with the little change that happened due to the entry of Croatia in the European Union, but that obviously doesn't change that much the balance of power. And that takes us to factor number two, which is intra-group cohesion. So to what extent the members of a political group, they vote together, or to what extent they are united. And this, as we noticed that at VoteWatch doing the analysis, varies by policy area. On top of the screen, we see what's the status in terms of cohesion in the political groups when it comes to agriculture. And the graph shows us that, for example, that the green pillar is much bigger than the other pillars. That shows us that the green group in the European Parliament is more cohesive when voting on agriculture issues than the other groups. And second to them come the EPP, the blue pillar. However, the situation is different when it comes to civil liberties. The socialists and Democrats are more cohesive than the Liberals and the EPP. So on these issues, the Socialists and Democrats, as well as the Green, they find it easier to agree inside their own group. And that makes them stronger in the plenary to be able to push for their proposals and their amendments. Factor 2B is intra-group participation, which is the extent to which the members of the Parliament do show up when it comes to voting in the European Parliament. Obviously, the more your members show up in the plenary and vote in a cohesive way, the higher the chances that your group wins the votes and shapes the European legislation the way you want. This intra-group participation doesn't vary that much across policy areas. But it does vary from one political group to another. And we see that so far in this EP7, the current term of the Parliament, again, the Greens were slightly more likely to participate in votes in the European Parliament's plenary than the other groups. Second to that come, but at a very small margin, the EPP and the SND, with the Liberals behind. But what this picture also tells us is that the groups at the left and at the right, you see there the radical left, the dark red pillar, but also the ECR, the Conservatives and Reformists, the black pillar, and then the EFD, Europe of Freedom and Democracy, the light blue pillar, being smaller, that is, they participate much less than the groups at the center in voting European Parliament's plenary, and that obviously has an effect on their capacity to influence legislation. What we wanted to do next was to measure to what extent the fact that the members of a political group do show up in voting in the European Parliament's plenary and vote in a cohesive way, to what extent does this change the actual balance of power, which we can think of as only in terms of nominal power, the number of seats? Is there a difference? Does it make a big difference that the members of a political group do show up and the members of other political group show up less often? And in order to do that, we created this picture. Here we see two pillars for each of the seven political groups. The pillar on the left-hand side and the lighter, in a lighter color, shows the nominal power of a political group as a percentage of seats that group has in the parliament, whereas the pillar on the right-hand side for each of the seven political groups shows the percentage, the actual power percentage of that group, factoring in the participation and the cohesion of that group. So what this picture tells us, as you see, for example, for the Socialists and Democrats, their actual power in terms a nominal power multiplied by participation and multiplied by cohesion rate is actually bigger than their nominal power. So they actually gain from the fact that their members are more cohesive and participate more in votes. The same happens for the European People's Party. You see that their real power is bigger than their nominal power in the parliament. For the Liberals, there's no change. But who loses are the groups at the sides, the groups at the left and right-hand side of the political spectrum, whose MEPs are less cohesive and participate less in votes, so that decreases their power even more. This picture varies by policy area, and I've chosen two examples. First one on agriculture. The fact that the EPP members are very cohesive, that provides the EPP a power of over 40% in the House, and the actual power of the Socialists and Democrats goes down because they are less cohesive. It's the other way around on issues that regard civil liberties and gender equality, for example, where on gender equality the real power of the SND and EPP are almost at the same level because EPP is much less cohesive than the Socialists and Democrats. And the factor number three that influences the extent to which each of the groups are able to influence legislation is obviously whom they create coalitions with, so to what extent are they able to be part of a winning majority. And this again varies by policy area. We now have the picture on agriculture because this was one of the issues most voted in the past couple of years in the parliament. And on the left-hand side, we see the allies of the Liberals and Democrats, and we see that the ALDE, for example, is much more likely to make coalition with ECR. No wonder about that. They are both pro-free market groups, the most pro-free market groups in the European Parliament. But that also prevents them from winning the votes because they are smaller than the EPP and SND. And this picture on the right-hand side shows us the allies of the EPP when it comes to agriculture, and that it shows us that on these issues, the EPP and the SND have voted together over 80% of times. That means that they make the running in the House on this issue. On other areas, when it comes to civil liberties, the picture is totally different. On the left-hand side here, we have the extent in which ALDE makes alliances at voting time with the rest of the political groups. So ALDE votes much more with the SND and the Greens than with the EPP when it comes to civil liberties. And that allows them usually to win the votes. So on issues such as civil liberties, gender equality, or environment, there is a center-left majority in the European Parliament, even though it doesn't include the European People's Party, the biggest group. So what kind of ideological footprint do we have on European legislation in this current term for the European Parliament? By policy area, I've chosen a couple of examples. When it comes to dossiers that come from the Econ Committee, Economic and Monetary Affairs dossiers, the votes on these issues are won clearly by the center-right, so it's EPP winning almost 100% of the votes, and ALDE a little bit over 90%. That's because the two of them make a coalition. When it comes, however, on environmental issues, we see the Liberals and Democrats winning much more than the other two groups. So ALDE, even though they are only the third largest in the House, they win much often on environmental dossiers than the Socialists and Democrats or the EPP. They are in a clearly a kingmaker position. Similarly, for the internal market dossiers, with ALDE winning more votes than the other groups. And an interesting picture when it comes to gender equality dossiers with the Liberals and then all the groups on the left winning around 90% of the votes and EPP going down to 70% due to their lack of cohesion but also a reduced capacity for creating coalitions. When it comes to budget, these three groups at the center, the EPP, the SND, and ALDE, usually vote together. Therefore, they're on the winning side on over 90% of the dossiers, so they create the parliament's position on budget. The conclusions for this part of the presentation before going to our new project is that the cohesion trends in the European Parliament for the political groups have gone slightly up for this current term. Despite the fact that the Parliament has got more power and is voting on more important issues, there are more legislative issues being voted in the European Parliament. So despite this fact, the political groups, the transnational political groups in the House, have remained cohesive throughout. Of course, the situation may change less or a lot in the next European Parliament term when we will see that there's going to be a new balance of power with the political groups at the sides winning more seats in the Parliament, but that's something that that Simon will cover more. But the question is now, after I've shown you this data, which is more for EU policy or politics geeks, the question is, what do we do about the people that don't understand that much about European politics and they are not interested in all of this graph? The challenge that VoteWatch faces is to bring the non-experts to the European elections next year. So how do we inform the public about what kind of issues are voting in the Parliament and how the parliamentarians decide on citizens' behalf. So for that, our first effort was to launch this MyVote 2014 project, which is a new website. It's myvote2014.eu, which is targeting young voters. It does so by simplifying some of the data that we have on the website. So out of our extensive database of over 4,700 roll call votes of the parliamentarians collected in this term, we have selected 15 issues that we thought are the ones that would bring the youth to the website and to vote next year. And we've shown how the members of the European Parliament voted on this issue. We've simplified all of these 15 items from the bureaucratic and political language of the European Parliament into simple questions for ordinary citizens. And the most interesting feature of the website is what we call Cast Your Vote, which is a voting calculator. It takes you as a citizen, as a user of the website, through this quiz of 15 questions. It allows you to vote on these same issues that the members of the European Parliament have voted. So you can just pretend that you are an MEP yourself and you put yourself in the shoes of a member of the European Parliament and you vote on issues such as should academic standards be harmonized throughout the European Union, or should the government investments in jobs for youth be exempted from the targets on budget deficit. And other issues particularly of interest for the young voters. And as with any voting calculator that you may be familiar with. At the end of the whole exercise, after you voted on the 15 issues, you see which members of the European Parliament come closest to your views. So you get this scale in percentages of which MEPs you match more or less, and you see where exactly you stand. The innovation that this tool brings compared to other tools that existed in the past is that you can actually compare your vote to the votes of the members of the parliament. So you compare facts with facts, not your positions with the promises of the parties that they can do during the electoral campaign, which may not be actually respected when it comes to decision making in the parliament. The second innovation is also that you can go to individual level and you see you can compare your votes to the votes of an individual member of the parliament, not only with the party as a whole, as there may be variations inside one of the groups or the national party. And then you can also compare two MEPs, for example. And we've chosen in this screenshot Daniel Cohn-Bendit, the co-leader of the Greens group in the parliament, on the left-hand side, and someone familiar to you, perhaps, Nigel Farage, on the right-hand side. And we show to what extent they agree and they disagree on these 15 issues. And you see the votes cast by Daniel Cohn-Bendit here and those cast by Nigel Farage here. You'll obviously notice that they don't agree that much in the European Parliament. But then you can make your own choice on who to follow. Okay, so I think that concludes the presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doro. Well, I think that looks like hours of fun myself. And if you feel like partaking, you can find it on www.myvote2014.eu. So thank you. Simon, let's get right into it now. What can you tell us about what Doro has said that could somehow translate? I mean, looking at the behaviour of those MEPs, have they managed to communicate what they're doing into perhaps something that might be seen at the ballot box, at least in terms of turnout? Because I suppose in the end, that's what we're talking about, isn't it? Will it be different? Will people bother to come out and vote? We're not talking about what kind of result we get. It's turnout.
Well, I think there's two... will it be different raises two issues. One, will it be different in terms of will people bother voting? Less than 45% voted in the last elections. Less than 29% of under 35s. And secondly, will it be different in terms of what people do when they're voting? Are they going to be voting just on purely national issues, national parties, national political choices, or are they going to be voting on the basis of European aspirations, European choices? And I think, on the one hand, you know, as a political scientist hat, head of the government department, professor of EU politics, I'll say, no, of course it's not going to be different. We have a model of European elections that says that they're midterm swings against national parties. Governing parties will do badly. They're dominated by domestic issues, domestic personalities. It's all going to be about how much we love Nigel and how much we dislike Dave and Ed. And you know that's of course is going to be a very powerful theme in the European Parliament elections, not just in Britain but in every EU member state. But I think this time there's reason to think why it could be different, and this does relate to what Dora has just presented, which is that the salience of European issues are now much greater than they were 5 years ago, both in terms of the Eurozone crisis, in terms of the way the different political families or different choices that are available for solving the crisis, a sort of centre-left view of more critical of the austerity measures versus a classic EPP-dominated EU right now, you can perceive. And also in terms of choices on how far or how fast we need to keep moving in terms of European integration and what that means for countries like the UK. And so there I think what Vote Watch has found is that the choices people make in these elections influence the size of these political groups in Brussels, and the size of those political groups in Brussels influences the type of EU we have, influences the type of political choices we're going to be having in the future and the type of direction of policy. Do we want a more centre-left, centre-right, more liberal, more green, more Euros, less integrated EU? Those types of choices are available to us as voters at the ballot box. Not just can we use this as a protest to on domestic politics? These are choices about our future in Europe and what future of Europe we want. And so I think there is an argument to be made that this time will be different because those choices are much more salient. There's much more information now to citizens available about those choices, and that's not just us, Vote Watch, that's lots of other types of websites and activities. Younger voters using social media to engage or understand European politics, bypassing national media, where, quite frankly, I don't want to be rude about the BBC, but quite frankly,
you can be now because I'm not working for it.
Okay, great. Gloves are off. Okay.
No.
Okay. National media is dominated by political editors whose bread and butter is their national political soap opera, and they just are completely ignorant about Brussels or anything that goes on. So the only way we can ever communicate what the choices available in European politics to citizens is to completely ignore the national media and just go through the new social media to get to citizens. And this time around, with the rise of social media, I think that may well make a difference, and I hope it makes a difference, particularly for younger voters who did not really show up at the last election. So that's where we are.
Mats, let me bring you in here. I mean, do you agree? It's true, isn't it, that now, in fact, partly because of the national media, people are looking at coverage of Greece and German elections and what have you, and maybe they're realising that some of these things affect them. But does that translate into the European elections? Is there an understanding that actually those MEPs have the influence? We've seen that the issues like agriculture and the economy have been the big issues where they're voting, but do people really realise and make that step? Will it bring them out? Will it make them vote on European issues, do you think?
Well, I don't think people in general will have a sort of good understanding of that, because partly that is because politicians themselves don't have a good understanding of that.
Well, that's right. It's not just the media, is it?
So basically, it's this whole idea of, and I agree with Simon, in theory, there should be a lot more interesting. Sorry?
You've got a habit of saying you agree with me.
But you're stealing my views on Twitter and stuff. So, I mean, you're all welcome to them, obviously, but at least give me some credit, you know? And now I lost my
sorry.
Thought.
You agree. You were about to agree.
I was about to agree with you. Maybe I should disagree then. I agree with you that in principle, because the Eurozone crisis has basically meant that EU integration has gone away from institutions, business regulations, the kind of abstract, boring, well, it's not abstract, but boring stuff that don't tend to dominate national elections. It's moved into the domain of taxation and spending, particularly for the Eurozone, obviously. And it's always over taxation spending and national elections are fought. So in theory, there should be a translation there to the European elections. And certainly in some countries, there is a left-right choice, as Simon rightly pointed out, austerity versus less austerity. And that's going to be reflected in the European Parliament. Now, against that, though, and this is what I mean about politicians not sure themselves exactly where this is going, is that we're moving in a more intergovernmental direction, I think, in the European Union, which means that the Brussels institutions, the European Parliament, the European Commission, might have actually a less significant role in the big sort of earth-shattering, defining decisions of European integration. And Merkel is on record having said several times that she wants to move in a more intergovernmental direction. So, yes, it's true that this has sort of trickled through, European policy has trickled through more into more areas that people care about, so therefore that should be reflected in European Parliament elections, but at the same time, actually, most of the decisions are now being taken in national capitals rather than in Brussels, so therefore it would be a perfectly rational decision not to spend much time on the European elections, if you're so inclined. Now, can I make two points about the European Parliament in general, though, just to sort of spice it up a bit? Because do you want me to do that?
Yes,
or
feel free.
We continue in an amicable manner?
No. Okay. Amicable.
So, spice it up, yeah. There are two things about the European Parliament which I think we need to remember. When we talk about will it be different next time, the first one is that in virtually every single treaty, the European Parliament has gained more powers. That has been a trend from the SEA, which was the first treaty that came into force after the European Parliament elections, right? And most definitely it was the case in the Lisbon Treaty, where co-decision has now been extended to 90% of all EU decisions. So the European Parliament has incrementally and constantly gained powers. That has not been reflected in voting turnout. You would expect that if the European Parliament was the ultimate answer to the democratic deficit, then you would expect voters to come out and respond to the fact that the European Parliament is getting more powers. That is what we would expect. If you in here, and I can imagine some of you, argue in favor of the European Parliament getting more powers to close the democratic deficit, then you will need to expect also that voters come out in greater numbers to vote for European Parliament. The opposite has happened. In 1979, the average turnout in the European elections was 62%. In 2009, the average turnout across Europe was 43%. So there's an inverse relationship between powers and voter turnout.
You're comparing apples with pears.
No, I'm not. So the question is, why is that? That's my first point. The second point is, which links to my point about intergovernmentalism. Actually, you hear more rude things about the European institutions now in Berlin and Paris than you do in London. And I was up at the Conservative Party conference in Manchester just before, and I heard a lot of rude things. So that's pretty, you know, that's pretty significant. So I think there is also a lack of political faith in the European Parliament's ability to deliver. And I think that's particularly true in Germany, which is, of course, the most important country at the moment in the European Union, where you both have, I'll finish on this point, where you both have political opinion, the Chancellor, Chancellery, being very sceptical of the European Parliament, giving more powers to the EP. Same thing with the parliamentarians, with the Bundesverfassungsgericht, the Constitutional Court. In this whole setup, you have a lot of scepticism towards the European Parliament. And trust in the European Parliament has dropped to an all-time low in Germany. It's at 33% at the moment. Of 13 European and national institutions tested in a recent opinion poll, the European Parliament ranked second from last. And you were only beaten by
so
the European
basically
Commission.
What you're saying, Matt. So basically what you're saying is the European Parliament doesn't really deserve the power that it's got, more or less. But let's get
that's not quite what I said. I said you would expect an increase in turnout, and yes. I'm posing a challenge
and yet, of
to
course,
everyone.
We've
Why
seen
is it
a
not
decrease
happening?
In turnout for national elections as well, which is all over the place. And just look at what happened in Austria just at the weekend and everywhere else. But that's maybe not as part of the narrative. But anyway. Gege, do you?
Are you a neutral chair?
Do you feel no? But just pointing the fact out that there has been a reduction in turnout at national elections as well as European parliamentary elections.
Yeah, that's true. But
so that
yeah,
you
that's
have to
that's true. But
it's,
you need to compare it to the individual countries and see what's actually going on.
We'll go to Simon because he's the man on this. Gege, do you think that there is enough at stake? For people to feel that they want to go and vote in European parliamentary elections, because in a way that is what it comes down to, people feeling there isn't enough to play for, you know, that these people aren't really doing things that are really going to influence our lives enough. I mean, how can you as the public affairs officer for the European Parliament tell people it's actually worth voting and there are issues there that we can affect?
I'm not sure it's a question of whether it's worth voting or not, because that is influenced by a lot of other factors. I will get back to Matt, because I partly agree, partly disagree with him, just like usually we do on Twitter. But I would turn it around and say that this time it is going to be different, that's for sure. The European Parliament elections, whether it's going to result in a bigger turnout or not, that will depend on a lot of other factors that are unrelated to the European Parliament. If you look at the data since 1979, you see that the reason I said it's apples with pears is because you're comparing different European Union or a different European community, different member states. You also see that, for example, in countries in the UK as well, you see a sudden rise in the turnout.
which can partly be due to the fact that it coincides with other elections, can partly be due to the fact that there are more Eurosceptics present. We see next year in Belgium, for the first time ever, the European Parliament elections will coincide with national elections and regional elections. Would that increase or decrease the turnout? Would that be, if the turnout increases, would that be down to the fact that the issues that are at stake are different? Or is it just a simple coincidence? In Hungary, it's probable, maybe, the European Parliament elections will coincide with national elections. Again, you can expect a higher turnout. So that's why I'm saying there are a lot of factors at play. And it's very difficult sometimes to single out one of these factors. But coming back to why this is different. First of all, to say that it should be an MEP sitting here. We did our best to find an MEP for this event, because they are the ones who represent the European Parliament. And they should be the ones answering this question. But being midweek, they're all in Brussels. So it's me who is going to speak unofficially for the European Parliament. If I go back to when I was a student, I actually wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be present at this discussion because I wouldn't be interested. I went to law school and I failed all my EU exams, all my EU law exams, partly because I felt that the EU was the most boring thing that was ever taught to me, and partly because it just seemed all far away. I think it has all changed with the crisis. There are much less people who would say that the EU is less relevant to their life or that the EU is boring. There are still, the argument is still around, but it's definitely less relevant. Here I can 100% agree with Mats. What has been mentioned more and what can be an issue and what will be an important issue is the question of democratic deficit, whether there is a democratic deficit at the EU level or not. whether it's a perceived or real democratic deficit. Before talking about the democratic deficit, coming back to Doru's presentation, I think it was great because it highlighted a democratic surplus, that people very rarely talk about the democratic surplus in the European Parliament. European parliamentarians can forge alliances across the ASEL with different political groups. That's the nature of how the European Parliament works, while at the national parliament, you're unlikely to vote against the government if you're in the government coalition, because that would cause that might cause the fall of the government, or turn the parliament into the most rebellious parliament, like we hear quite a lot about Westminster lately. In the European Parliament, that's the nature of normal business. So in that sense, it is more democratic the way an MEP has room for maneuver. That's what I would call a democratic surplus. There is a perceived or often mentioned democratic deficit, which is twofold. One is many people criticize the intergovernmental level that Mats has been mentioning so much, whether it's the ESM, the Troika, austerity imposed by the European Council, whether it's the ECB banking supervision and the scrutiny rights of the European Parliament, you name it. There are a lot of criticisms leveled at the European Council. Whether it's true or not, we could debate that quite long, I guess. That it lacks democratic legitimacy. And it's the European Parliament that can restore the control, the scrutiny functions of the European Parliament over the Troika, over the ECB, and so on, is the one that can restore that democratic legitimacy that lacks from the intergovernmental level. There's also criticism that is levied against the European Parliament, which is that the Parliament elections are not really about the European Parliament. That it's about a national election, it's about national protest votes, as Simon was mentioning. There's no manifesto by the political groups that you could use to hold members to account whether they voted according to that or not, because of the democratic surplus that exists in the European Parliament. What is going to change in this regard is the Lisbon Treaty has brought in the right for the European Parliament to elect the President of the European Commission, and obviously it will be elected on the basis of the proposal made by the European Council, but the European Council's proposal has to take into account the results of the European Parliament elections. And there's also a declaration number 11, just to be really boring, attached to the Lisbon Treaty, which very few people actually read, which says that the European Council and the European Parliament has to go into negotiations before the European Council proposes a candidate for the post of the President of the European Commission, which changes or might change or has the potential to change this perceived democratic
Do you think that is really going to be the burning issue that gets people out of the house, though, the fact that they might influence the election of the European Commission president? And that's a big might.
As Simon likes to say, this is a team play, politics. And I think there's no better example than what he just mentioned before the debate. When the first foreign players started to come to play at the Premier League, or back then it wasn't called Premier League actually, the Times predicted that nobody's going to support football teams anymore because there will be no more local players. We see that there is continued support for Arsenal, for Chelsea and so on, even though they have quite a number of non-local foreign players. The same way, people can be excited about politicians who come from a different country. It's not impossible.
Not impossible. Okay.
They're excited about it.
I'm sure the commission, the college will be delighted. We'll tell them. Simon, you're pulling at, well, had I a sleeve, you would be pulling at it. Let me come back to you and for a brief comment from the panel, and then over to you and on the floor to give your views and questions.
Well, I was going to say, on the commission president issue, I mean, we need to see whether there's going to be candidates or not. I mean, all of the political groups have said they want to nominate candidates. We could get candidates from everybody but the group that really matters, the EPP. If the EPP come up with a candidate, I think it's going to be fun to watch, and I think it could have this interesting extra European element to the campaign. It's not going to fundamentally change, but I think with rival candidates for the Commission President from the groups before the elections, I can see national media, even news, boring, dull newspapers, mm-hmm. Having kind of pull-out sections in the magazine. Who might be the next Commission President? Interviews with them, their manifestos, some backstory about how dull these people are.
There's a lack of personality, you know, isn't there?
This is going to add a personality dimension to the policy dimension, which has often been missing, and also made it actually to defend the media, to make it difficult actually to report on the European element to the campaign. If there aren't faces to put to these policy positions, there will be faces to put to these policy positions, and hopefully there'll be some set-piece bust-up fights between these people on, you know, public disagreements over key issues or key promises they're going to make. You know, I promise to fix the cap, you know, whatever. So it wouldn't transform it, but I hope it'll add another element. There was one quick other thing I was going to say, which is European Parliament elections mean quite different things in each member state. And one thing we often forget in Britain is the electoral system can actually make a difference. This will be the first elections now. This will be 18 of the 28 member states are going to have elections where people are going to be voting for candidates, not parties. So in Britain, we have a list system. You vote for a party in your region. The candidates have no incentive to go campaign directly to the voters. In 18 of 28 member states, we're going to have open list systems where you actually go vote for a candidate. What we know from previous elections, those systems force MEPs, force candidates to go directly to voters, to put leaflets through doors, to set up their own websites, to launch their own Twitter accounts and the rest of it. And this has had an impact on participation rates in elections and on engagement with these elections. We know that from previous elections. So this time around, there's another reason why it could be different. If only we had open lists in Britain, I think then it would really be different in here, because then we would see these candidates being... Because the difference is, let's say if we're standing from the same party, let's say Dora and I, God forbid, from the same party, Dora, but if we were in Britain, we'd both be sitting at home with our feet up, knowing that the party machine is going to run the campaign. But with an open list system, or STV in Ireland, we'd be out there saying, vote for our party, but make sure you put your X next to my name and not his, because I'm going to show up and I do this and blah, blah, blah. That changes the nature of the campaign. And this time round, with 18 of the 28 member states with these systems, that could be quite different.
What about you? What do you think? Give me a few hands there. Why don't we take three questions and comments? There's a lady here, gentleman here. If you could tell us where you're from and who you are, that would be helpful.
Hello, my name's Carol Thompson. I'm president of ELSA, which is the English Law Students Association, and I'm from King's College, also a lawyer. I just wanted to... You asked what can make people vote, and Simon's just more or less said what it would be. And for me, a few years ago, I was very enthusiastic about Europe, and I was trying to get the students engaged in it and arrange trips to the institutions and things like that. Now, when we take them to Parliament here in London, for example, we have an MP, they have surgeries, you have sort of a physical, you can have a relationship with that MP. When you go to Parliament, they can meet you and they can talk to you. The MEPs that we have in London, there are quite a few of them, it's almost impossible to reach out to them, to get them to respond to emails, and I think that's the issue. And I just wanted to say that it's what you said, Simon, that's exactly, that would increase voter turnout if you could identify and if you had some say in who the MEP was.
We got any former MEPs in the audience at all?
John, aren't you a former?
Do you But, I mean, do you think, is there a problem? I mean, you have massive regions. That's a. If we'll pass you the microphone. But, I mean, do you accept that the part of the problem is the accessibility of the MEP, the lack of personality, the lack of connection?
Well, I was an MEP when they had constituencies, so I haven't been an MEP under the list.
And do you think that was a better system?
Well, I think it's certainly true that the list system that we have at the moment does make MEPs even more remote than they would otherwise be. Mm-hmm. But I was rather keen to make a different point, if I may,
please.
That in Britain, at any rate, next year, I think there's quite a good chance that the turnout will be higher because I think it's going to be attempted, at least, to be turned into a referendum. Mm. I mean, UKIP are going to be saying that this is the chance to have a referendum in or out of Europe that the main parties are not offering you, or only offering you under circumstances that are more or less incredible. And I would be interested to know what people think about what dynamic that might have. Because you've got a situation where you could get UKIP saying where the campaign to leave the EU. You'd have presumably the Labour Party and others saying that they were the campaign to stay in. But the problem with the Conservative Party is that half their MEPs want to leave and the other half want to stay. And so the question is, what would happen if it becomes effectively the referendum that isn't?
Absolutely. That's a point, surprisingly, that hasn't come up yet. A very important one. Can I ask the gentleman here? You want to make a point, and then.
Thank you. My name is Vincenzo Celeste. I'm from the Italian Embassy here in London. I served for 5 years in Brussels, and so I know a bit. Sorry, I had a question concerning the new system for the election on the president of the Commission, and given the description that was made at the beginning of the presentation about the dynamics, I was wondering whether, in your views, the election of a president, so the choice made by parties before the election to indicate a candidate, the fact that this candidate, at the end of the day, should be elected, so he should gather a majority, doesn't this have an impact in the dynamics in the European Parliament, introducing an element of majority versus opposition? And this might have an impact on the way the Commission would start working. I mean, in the sense that it was probably the program of the Commission would resemble more to a sort of government program supported by a majority. This was my first question. The other thing is just an observation for the electoral system. I do remember when I was in Brussels, so many MEPs were complaining about the fact that, for instance, in Italy, the system is based on not on the list of parties, but on the candidates. Why? Because the fact that is at the end of the day that the people at home, they don't know the people who are working really in Brussels, if they are working in Brussels, and if they are not working in Brussels, and they are very well known in Italy. I mean, this is the trade-off. In fact, people, I mean, MEPs that I know were really working hard in Brussels, they, for this reason, they were not coming often back to Italy, they were not known, and they lost the elections.
Yeah. It's a fair point, isn't it? This obsession with whether you turn up every time, maybe because you're actually talking to your constituents, which is, and not just being part of the Brussels bubble. But there's a few issues there, and then we'll come back to the floor. Maybe, Mats, you want to take up the issue, perhaps also that was brought up there on how much can this will this election be about Britain's place in Europe, and maybe a sort of prequel to the actual referendum, and actually how is it going to affect the campaign, particularly that some of those parties run, particularly the Tories.
Yeah, I'm desperately thinking about something clever to say here, but I sort of draw a blank, to be honest, because it is incredibly difficult to predict exactly what will happen. I agree with you that it could sort of be an effective referendum, but at the same time, we have one party that has already offered a referendum in that referendum. So, I mean, that is the policy option on the table. So I just don't think it will be sort of a pro-referendum vote for UKIP. That's if you want Britain to leave the EU. But actually, at the end of the day, people vote for UKIP because of domestic reasons, primarily. And I say this as a Europe geek, you know. I look at the EU all the time. I wish it was the case that they voted... I don't wish it was the case they voted only for UKIP because of the EU, but I wish it was the case that the EU featured much more prominently in the European elections. But I think if UKIP wins the next election, which they may well win the European elections, our polling suggests they could, then it will be because primarily, I would say it's because 70% of domestic issues, 30% max because of Europe. Now, just two quick points on some of these other things that have been mentioned. I think directly elected president, the directly elected European Commission president, will do absolutely nothing to make people vote. I mean, just I agree that there could be some sort of personality contest when Herman Van Rompuy, who's of course the European Council president, but when he was appointed, then the British media had a lot of fun with him, obviously, because he's a quite thankful target. I mean, he writes what he calls his poems, and he's just a very anti sort of. He's not the kind of character you would expect in British politics, and he was on the front page of various tabloids and so forth. But is that the kind of stuff they want? I just don't see how it would make any difference. I do, however, strongly endorse Simon's point about voting for candidates. I think that's absolutely crucial. We have a situation now, particularly in the UK, where we send some quite suboptimal MEPs to Brussels, to put it mildly. They don't show up. They don't vote, they don't do committee work. They are gaffe-prone, some more than others. Some of them have to resign. This one party, which I think is left with sort of half of its MEPs, the rest are gone somewhere. I don't know where they go, but they certainly aren't doing the work in European Parliament.
Which party is that?
It's UKIP. So, I mean, it's a big issue that there's not that accountability structure. And if you vote on actual candidates, I think there's much more kind of accountability. Although, don't make the mistake and think that the centre of gravity in the European Parliament will become any less sceptic if that happens. Because the flip side of that coin is that I very much doubt that Guy Verhofstadt would get away with some of the stuff that he says if he was actually held directly accountable for some of his ideas, for example, EU tax, for which there's absolutely no support in amongst the European public. I think that's...
Let me just move on to...
yeah, that was it. I have no more points.
Gyorgy, the idea of electing the Commission President is quite a central plank of your campaign, in a way, at the Parliament, and yet it doesn't seem to be, certainly not in Matt's view... the thing. The gentleman here is wondering, I think, to what extent would that affect the Commission and what it's meant to be or what it could become. Are you suggesting that might not be a good thing necessarily, or are you suggesting that it will change?
Frankly,
it'll become more of a government.
And I also wonder if this could be introducing a personal element, we could also introduce a national element. Sense, I mean, as Max was saying before, it is true that there will be probably more intergovernmental stuff in the EU. Mm-hmm. I wonder whether introducing, for instance, whether Martin Schulz could be the president of the Commission. He's a German, but he's a socialist. would this be changed? I mean, I don't have the answers, but just
any thoughts?
A lot.
Give me a few.
First of all, our campaign, which is the institutional information campaign, is not based on the candidates themselves, but on the fact that the European Parliament will elect the Commission President. Whether there will be candidates and how many candidates there will be, we don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know yesterday the socialists came out with the possible primary. We don't know whether there will be candidates or not. But we know the socialists are running a primary. The Greens said they will run a primary. We don't know about the EPP. We don't know about many other groups. So there is no confirmation whether the candidates will actually be there. And even if they are there, we will not be involved in that campaign. That's up to the political groups to run that campaign. What we are stressing, and I think it's very important to make the distinction, is that the European Parliament is going to elect the Commission President. And there will be a consultation between the Parliament and the European Council on that. And our information campaign is focusing on that. It's true, to be totally honest, and to mention the other side as well, that there are voices in Brussels who say that having Commission candidates risks turning the Commission from an honest broker into a politicized institution.
Which is
while the Commission is not a government, it is the guardian of the treaties. So it is. It should not function as a government. Obviously, British politicians have very strong views on that. So it's up to a politician to debate that. I'm just flagging up the where the debate lies. I would also like to mention that having the choice of the electoral system is a national choice. It's not an EU choice. It's up to each country to decide what system they run. And if I remember well. Back like 10, 15 years ago, the Tories officially supported an open list system, and it was Labour, it was actually New Labour, which decided on having a closed list system in the UK. Mm-hmm. So there was an ongoing debate in the UK. Mm-hmm. I wonder whether this debate will come back at one point, whether there is a point of changing the electoral system, mm-hmm. and it feeds into my final point on this. Which is that when you look at image of institutions, the NHS, the banks, and so on, very often you see that people who are very skeptical, for example, on the NHS in general, will say, but my local hospital is great. People who are skeptical about the banks and saying that the banks are terrible will say, but my local bank manager, I trust that guy or that lady. The problem very often with the image of the EU is that you cannot walk into your local EU. You don't have that direct experience with the EU. You see that as the general faraway thing, and that feeds into this negative bias.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Briefly, Simon, because then we'll go back to the floor, but can we also come back to the point about the debate within Britain about its place, whether it's a prequel or not, whether it's a rerun of a mini referendum? It will condition, in a way, you know, it's sharpening minds, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it may be in a positive sense as well.
I mean, UKIP will run this, I think I agree with John, and that UKIP will try and run this election as, this is your chance to come out and show the politicians we want a referendum now. So, you know, the Conservatives are saying you get a referendum if we get a majority at the next election, and that's a big if. And the others, we don't really know what their policies are on the referendum or not yet.
But Simon, this, just sorry to interrupt, but I'm just to UKIP cannot make that offer in any firmer way than Conservatives can. But I think what it will be is we are the only party that offer out, as opposed to Cast Iron Dave, who doesn't.
I accept.
Yeah.
But the problem is the other three, the three mainstream parties in British politics will all try and pretend the elections aren't happening, because they know they're going to lose. They know they're going to do badly in these elections. They're protest elections against the establishment. The Conservative Party is crossing its fingers they don't come third. That's a disaster for Cameron. Labour, Ed is worried they're going to come second to UKIP. That would be a disaster for Labour. The Liberals are worried they're going to get completely wiped out with no MEPs. So all three of them will try and centralise their campaign and make sure they don't spend any money. And we'll send instructions to their troops just to talk about local elections, which are happening at the time. So UKIP will be running a European election campaign, and the other three parties will be running local election campaigns and pretend the European elections aren't happening. And afterwards, because they can then say, well, they weren't really European elections, it was all about the local elections. Mm-hmm. And so we can't really infer anything from the fact UKIP did really well in these things. So, I mean, that's what I fear will happen in Britain. Every British government, knowing that they're going to lose midterm European Parliament elections in Britain, has done everything they can to pretend these elections aren't happening. That's partly why we've had such low turnout in these elections in the past in the UK.
That's interesting. And in contrast to what a French liberal was telling me was going to happen in France, which is in order to oppose the National Front, the pro-European parties are fighting a European election on pro-Europe platforms. But there we are, that's the difference. Any more questions and comments? I think we'll take a little batch of them now, and then we can come back as we're running out of time. So let's start from the left and move over to the right.
Hello, Arthur Scalier, editor-in-chief of the newfederalist.eu. I'd like to link back to voter disinterest that has been mentioned. I'd like to even talk about complete, gradual, and increasing voter disillusion. If we look at the past 30 years, indeed participation has been decreasing, and political parties have been proposing ideas and projects that have to a certain extent converged. And this is for one very simple reason. It's the fact that globalization and the international economy is increasingly governed by rules versus political choices. You have to have the 3% deficit. You have to have 60% of debt. You have to have an open economy. You have to target inflation. You have so many rules, not only at the international level, and Europe is here to implement these international rules, and national governments are here to implement these European rules. So in the end, what do politicians have to offer? What can they do apart from choosing the color of the flowers that they want to put on old historical statues? Voters tend to feel that. They tend to feel that whoever they vote for eventually will not really change their lives. And the paradoxical issue here is that this is precisely the results that, to a certain extent, Europe and other structures have been seeking. They've been seeking to establish liberal democracy, this might seem very in the line of Fukuyama's approach, but this is more or less where we're heading to. Sort of passive liberal democracies where old political, historical projects tend to be wiped out by, oh, but how are you going to finance that? You want to double your cultural budget because you believe culture is great. Well, sorry, you can't. Your deficit is 3.5%. So when you have such important rules which tend to favor stability, how do you want voters to, in the end, go to the streets and be in favor of revolutionary projects, to put it like this?
Interesting point. Yeah. Green T-shirt man. You're going to make the same point. That's spooky.
Did you make it up now?
I don't believe you. Okay, over slight. So we've got a gentleman there and with the white T-shirt and the gentleman. Okay, I can see you. Right.
Giles Bailey. I'm a business consultant. Across the 28 countries, do you feel that there is a country that does the EU very well and particularly separates out the national politics from the EU politics and actually in some way engages their population around the debate? Because clearly they don't do it very well in this country and perhaps in Germany and France, but perhaps one of the smaller countries is almost a template for how you can engage the population around these kinds of debates.
Excellent. We'll store that one up. Behind you is at least one person, possibly two.
Okay. My name is Adnan Dalsworth. I'm an LSE student since a couple of days, so very happy. I'm just wondering about the point that was made about this voter turnout that's not reflected in the increase in powers. I was wondering what the stance is of the panel on education on this point, because I'm wondering to what extent do people actually know about what Europe is doing, especially, you know, if I look at myself in secondary school, I was, you know, I had courses on national politics, like how that works, what the powers of government are and stuff, but I wasn't taught anything about, you know, how Europe functions. So, and if I ask my friends, you know, they don't really know how things work, you know. So I'm wondering, would that help in making people more interested in politics if they would just know more about it? Secondly, isn't Europe just not, isn't it too complex, actually? Can we just not make it simpler? In particular, I'm thinking about why does everything have to be intergovernmental, and why do you have to have that barrier between the citizen and where the politics are actually happening?
Okay, yes, the man with the microphone.
Right, I'll just continue right away. My name is Timo. I'm also just an LSE, student. I'm from the Netherlands, and several times there have already been the recognition that the voting will probably be, most likely be, either a yes or no referendum, sort of, on Europe, at least that's the case how it's framed in the Netherlands, or it's going to be on domestic policies. And while this recognition has been done a couple of times by several panel members, I'm missing the solutions. That's maybe in addition to my previous speaker on, okay, how do you solve the focus problem of the elections?
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move down, please. And man with the white T-shirt. Sorry.
Gervais Bolden. I work in the EU team and DEC. I just wanted to pick up on the issue of the democratic deficit and the I think it's often kind of assumed a priori that somehow the European Parliament is the solution towards that. We've already touched on slightly the fact that this is a body that's elected by 40% turnout with, you know, percentages that are even voting on those issues like far low, so you're talking about kind of 10%, 15% legitimacy. And it's often said that the only two fast rules about the European Parliament is that it will vote for more powers for itself and it will vote for more money for the EU budget. Those are the only two things you can rely on. And I don't really understand so much the criticism then of decisions made by the Council more and this being undemocratic in some way. I mean, these are ministers or heads of state elected usually with a 70% turnout where people actually understand what the issues are about. They understand who they voted for. So I really don't understand how more powers to the Parliament in any way is going to solve a democratic deficit. I think really that's the main point.
Yeah, fair point. Thank you. Let's have a look at the time.
I just wanted to pick up slightly on the thing also saying what the gentleman just made, the point about more education. Try explaining the joint decision-making process of the Parliament and the council to someone, it takes probably an entire semester. I'm not sure you'd really get there, and it further underlines my point about I don't see how the Parliament's solutions are.
I wonder if it's more complicated than national politics, though. I think it's about the will to understand sometimes, but there you are. Let's go over to this side, and we have about five questions. I think that's probably what we could. One, two, three, four, five, yes. And then we'll come back to us.
Anne Corbett, a former visiting fellow at the European Institute. Despite your best efforts to ask people why the European Parliament matters, we've had a tremendous amount of technical talk. Can you try and get out of the panel before we all go home why we should actually, if we're not in the Brussels bubble or particularly involved with UKIP or the National Front, why we should actually care about the European Parliament?
I will.
My name is Julia, and I'm an LSE MPA student here. And echoing what she just said, Anne just said, I originally grew up in the US, and I am very accustomed to our political system and our campaign system. And I'm also an active Democrat back home. So I was very active with MoveOn.org and a number of other organizations such as those. And I'm very fortunate. I also get a vote in Belgian elections. And I haven't seen or heard of anything where it'll encourage me. And I think VoteWatch, it seems really exciting that you guys have this new tool. But I can't imagine any of my family back home hearing about it. I mean, I hope that you guys have a campaign surround to really push it out, but I'd really like to hear more about what kind of talk there is about really pushing out the vote in order to get that discussion going about how the EP is relevant.
I think if you had an MEP running for Parliament up here, you might have a more impassioned, you know, not because these guys can't be passionate, I don't know, but the, you know, they are absolutely not. We have a civil servant, you know, we have a slightly sceptical think tank here, but, you know, they're
a boring professor.
And
sure.
Boring professors. Yes, exactly. But if they don't do it, I'll tell you, okay? I'm going to ask them and then I'll tell you. But I'm a neutral chair. Carry on.
Do you want me to go first?
No, I want to hear
more questions.
Yeah, yeah, because we're going to rush through them and you can't answer every single one.
I'm Ros Trinick. I work for a PR lobbying agency. I wanted to ask the panel how likely they think it is that there will be an MEP expenses scandal and what impact that will have on voter engagement.
We've had them.
Okay, yes, we have had them.
Hiya. We've heard from the Dutch chap over there that it's going to be used as a protest vote in the Netherlands. We've heard from the panel that it's going to be used as a protest vote in the UK. It's probably quite a similar picture across Europe. And it's been going for a while now, the European Union. Why is it that it's only really there to sort of self-justify? Why is there why has it not managed to work itself into a position where anyone takes it seriously?
Okay. That's another version of the questions, I think, here. Okay, and last question, and then we're going to have to get into the meat of it.
Hi, I'm Michael Hume. I'm an economist at the LSE, but I'm really just speaking as a layperson who has voted for 20 years in EU elections. But I vote out of duty, not because I actually think it's necessarily that important. And I think the basic problem here, this disconnect, is that there's no agenda that's set by MEPs when you ask to vote for them. There's no manifesto. There's nothing there for you to actually say, I agree with that, apart from broad principles. And inevitably, they get cast in terms of the national debates in each country. So for me, it seems that the reason that you get this huge focus on national issues is because of a void, because there is nothing there. And I don't agree that the European Commission is just seen as the guardian of some treaty, of the treaties. They propose the legislation. They are effectively like a government that initiates legislation. They're the ones that effectively should be selling their manifestos to people, and they're not. Now, I'm not suggesting it's realistic for one moment that we have directly elected commissioners across the whole of the policy areas, but people in this country know about Michel Barnier, they know about Barroso, but they're not allowed to get near them democratically, and I think that is ultimately the problem.
Okay, so I'm going to start from this side this time. Dora, do you want to make any points here? I mean, first, let's just avoid all technical language and really try hard. There's nothing there, it's too complicated, and why should we care?
Well...
Welcome to Britain.
Well, I'm not that much of an expert in British politics, but I think the situation is not that different from most of the other member states in the sense, in the way the electoral campaign for the European elections is being conducted. I saw that Simon has taken some notes that in
but
some
look,
other countries
you,
it's different.
You showed us the policies.
Yes.
And you told us we're voting more about agriculture, economy, this, that, or whatever. But what does that actually mean? I mean, what are the things that people are voting about, making decisions about that actually are of any relevance to people's lives? That's kind of what you want to know. Why should your family, why should your grandma, why should your niece or your nephew come out and vote?
I think the answer to this question, as to other questions that were asked from the room, such as whether these elections are going to become a referendum pro-EU, anti-EU, both in UK or France, or why should we care, why should people turn out to vote, lies a lot in the hands of the national parties and the European parties in the way they will choose to conduct the electoral campaign. If they pretend that these elections don't happen, or they choose to do it in a local way, just as Simon mentioned, then obviously this is a mistake. And now I'm answering also to your question. If, on the other hand, they choose to show some of the issues that were voted in the European Parliament and how they voted and how they were different from one another on these issues, then that's going to be a different thing. Issues such as, for example, the EU budget and obviously the contribution that Britain brings to the EU budget. Some of the political forces in the parliament and some of the national parties in the UK have voted to increase that budget, others voted to decrease it. Issues such as the tax on financial transactions, which is particularly sensitive in the UK. Some members of the European Parliament from this country voted to support the tax on financial transactions, others voted against it. And the same goes for issues such as budgetary surveillance. Should the EU get involved in surveilling the way the economic policies are being drafted by the national governments, by the national parliaments, or shouldn't they? And if this is being done, this is going to be done by the European Commission, what indicators should they use? Should they use more economic indicators? Should social indicators also be included? These are all issues in which the political families in the Parliament have voted differently. The left had one idea, the right had a different idea, and if all of these issues are brought to the public, both by the national and European political parties on the one hand, and other civil society actors, by the journalists and by the NGOs, I think the campaign will be different. It will show to the people why should they care and how these issues and the decisions being made there, and also the decisions that they make for the on whom to vote and who to take these decisions in the parliament on their behalf, really have an impact on their lives. Obviously, the problem is that from the moment a decision is reached in the parliament until that piece of legislation actually has impact on the everyday life takes about probably 2-3 years. But that's.
But this is the point about the complexity, Simon. Is that a fair point, that actually things take so long, they're so complicated, that actually you're on a hiding to nothing and people are never going to really understand it?
Backwards. I'll make very quick points. One, we wouldn't need the European Parliament if all decisions in the Council could be made by unanimous decision. You can't make decisions by unanimous decision amongst 28 member states. So as soon as you move to make decisions by majority, you have to have a check on that majority. That's why we have the European Parliament. So therefore you have a decision-making procedure which is a standard, very simple decision-making procedure, which is a standard bicameral decision-making procedure, exactly the same as in Germany, in the US, in the UK, in any other bicameral system of government. It's not complex, it's very simple. Try and explain 3 rounds of voting between the House of Lords and the House of Commons, or the procedure for shuttling legislation backwards and forwards between the Bundestag and the Bundesrat. If you go into that detail, it's very complicated. It's not. It's simple. It's a bicameral system of government. If we don't want to be part of this bicameral system of government, let's have a referendum, let's vote to leave it. But this is where we are, right? So why does it matter? Go to My Vote 2014 and go and vote, and send me an email if there's not motivated you to be more interested in voting in the European Parliament choices. I dare you. Right? I mean, come on. You go there and you'll see that actually they're voting on real things that really matter to you. A lot of things that matter to you far more than those idiots down the road in the House of Commons,
like
all the rubbish they're
what
voting on.
What sort of things are they voting on?
You know, like, for example, rights on the free movement of persons. Rights on the free movement of persons across the EU are not decided by the House of Commons. They're decided by the European Parliament and the Council and the EU legislative process. So those things we're moaning about, which is motivating people to go and vote for UKIP in British elections, has got nothing to do with the British government and the House of Commons. It's all to do with the EU decision-making. If we're going to remove social security rights for EU citizens in the UK, that's not going to be done by the House of Commons. That's going to be done by the European Parliament. Go and vote.
The gentleman up there asked 2 questions, which was about, one question was, is there a small country? I think you assumed it must be a small country, and there might be a reason for that, actually. Maybe small countries need other countries to help them do things. So they have more of an interest in cooperation. Is there a small country that does it better, you know, that has a genuinely European campaign? Can you think of one? Why do you think it is the way it is? And also, do you agree with the idea that somewhere there's been a failure of the institution and its parts, MEPs, to communicate to people actually what they do and why it matters? Or is it the fault of national politicians, the media? Would it be solved by teaching people in schools?
I wouldn't judge or rate countries who is doing EU well and who is not. But definitely there are different approaches to
voting at the European Parliament elections or discussing EU issues. I know that the Irish, for example, are quite proud of their single transferable vote system, which if you talk to Irish constitutional lawyers, you will hear that that's the best system in the world. That is the mixture of a list system and a constituency system, practically, which combines the best of both systems, or the worst of both systems, depends on how you look at it. Finland has one of the most flexible list systems, where candidates on the party list are in an alphabetical order. They're not pre-ranked by the political party who puts them on the list, and it's up to you to decide which. Now you're not only voting on a party list, but you're actually voting on a person on that party list. But that also means that candidates are campaigning against each other to some extent, also because you want to highlight your personality on the list. In Luxembourg, it's even more complex, if I remember well. I think you have 6 votes, and you can share it and move it around on the different lists. So you can even share your vote between different political parties and different candidates. So there are different systems to use. As I think what matters is that the system that you use is in line with the traditions, the way people do politics in that country, the way people understand politics. And then the question arises whether we should have whether voting systems should be more aligned at European level, mm-hmm. in order not to have a situation where if people move from one country to another country, they have difficulties understanding.
But I think you're also talking not just about systems, but just about the nature of the debate. Is there a country?
Well, Matt,
Scandinavia, Matt?
No.
No?
No.
Sorry.
No.
No.
Okay. I'm going to move on at the risk of you know, cutting you a bit short here, because we've got to have time to drink. Matt, I'm interested in the fact, we started with you. You have a reputation for being quite sceptical about the EU.
You keep on saying that.
But you do. and yet you care about, you seem to care about people coming to vote. You seem to care about there being a European element to the European election. You seem to care about the fact that the power of the Parliament isn't reflected by the turnout. Why do you care? Why is it important?
I see what you're trying to do. I mean, I reject the premise of that whole question, because you're trying to sort of, you seem to be one of those sort of eccentric skeptics. Still, you care. I think it's just a different vision for how Europe should be organised. You shouldn't pigeonhole people on basis of that.
No, I'm not pigeonholing. I mean, I know, I've debated with Nigel Farage, for example, and where there is a commonality of view with everybody at this table is that Europe's important because it makes decisions that affect people's lives. So
yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a fair question. If you frame it like that, we wrote a document in 2009 ahead of the previous European elections, which said, "What is European Parliament? Why does it matter?" And of course, European decisions matter. I mean, it's 50% of business laws are now decided in one or another in Brussels. As I said, 90% of EU decisions are decided by the European Parliament, and of course, you know, you want voters to engage with that. I believe that, as I said earlier, if you actually had more and better informed debates around the European Parliament, you would have a much better European Parliament. I mean, I can go on about this, but basically, I will have a go at why you should vote. I will try that as well, since everyone else has tried that. So, if you're in Britain, so 10% of UK GDP is driven by financial services. The rules governing that market are heavily decided by decision in the European Parliament. 75% of UK GDP is driven by services. Rules governing that market is heavily driven by decision in the European Parliament. When you go to work and you have your employer says how many hours you can work, that is decided by the European Parliament. How much you pay in insurance, partly decided by European Parliament, for example, on Solvency II regulation and financial regulation, or an ECJ ruling, I stopped there because that's complicated. But roaming charges, how much you pay for calls and texts while you're abroad, decided by the European Parliament. Access to benefits for you EU citizens here in this room, if you, heaven forbid, don't get a job after you graduate from LSE, and I've heard that never happens, but if that hypothetically was happen, what rights you have to access benefits in this country is decided by the European Parliament. I mean, we can go on and on. So, I mean, concretely, there are several examples, and I would encourage communication people in the European Parliament to focus on that, rather than trying to be all things to all people, because then you're just going to confuse us.
Okay.
Now, but I want to say two
very
more things.
Very briefly, Mats, because we need to draw up.
Yeah, will do. I don't want to stand in between LSE students and their drinks. But ultimately, this is about the European elections will never become national elections. They will never become national elections. A government has two measures by which it intervenes in society: spending and regulation. Spending is what national elections are fought over. Regulation is never featured strongly in national elections. The EU is still primarily a regulatory body, not only but primarily. So it will never be national elections. Get that out of your head. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't encourage people to get involved, but it will not be national elections. Ultimately, this is about where we think the optimal entity around which we organize democratic accountability. And I really like your point about European Parliament versus the Council. And actually, the pendulum is not swinging back in favor of national parliaments, where with the Germans, the Brits, the Dutch in particular, are very keen on working with national parliaments as, you know, the ones that are ultimately responsible to are ensuring that democratic accountability is upheld, for example, through the red card mechanism.
Okay.
The final point is about ordnungspolitik, which is great. It's a great point up there. I'll end on this point. There's a big difference between a democratic deficit and a democratically chosen democratic deficit, if you follow me. Now, the most conspicuous example of democratically chosen democratic deficit is the Bundesbank in Germany. Now, no German would suggest that they should be politicized. So that's something that is chosen. It has buy-in from voters. It's when that democratic deficit becomes that democratic deficit that we have a problem. And I worry, as much as I'm in favor of spending restraints, I worry that that's precisely what we're seeing in the Mediterranean.
Okay, well, listen, thanks so much, all of you, Matt, Yogi, and Simon, and Doru, and to Sarah and all those who've helped organise here at the LSE and Vote Watch. Thanks for all of your comments. I hope you're fired up now to go and proselytise the word that whatever you vote, just vote. Let's hope it is different next time. Thanks, all of you, and see you next time.